Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower. And we are here until 5 a.m. And I'm back, and I'm happy to be back. And missed last week's Monday morning movie reviews, but we got more movies to talk about. We're going to play a little catch-up on our Monday morning movie reviews as well, since I was off last Monday. Talk about some of the films that came out last week and cover them and cover all the new ones. That's all coming up right here on WGN. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. A little bit later on, we are going to talk about some new pickup lines. We'll try them out on Esmeralda, see how they work. And it's Monday. That means my dad will call in. He missed his joke last Monday, so he's going to call in and tell one this morning to get everything back on track. And he'll call in a little bit later on because it's a jokey time. So there you go. We got a lot to get to. We want to get to it quickly. We have both Eric Childress and Colin Suter with me, and they join me every week to talk about the movies. And let's welcome them back after a week off. Here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
How are you, buddy?
Had a better night.
Yeah, well, the Cubs can't win every night.
No.
Here's the upside to it. Kershaw can't pitch every night.
That's right, but no Buck can announce.
That's right. And Colin, welcome back. Hi, Colin.
Hello there.
So we were off last week, so we missed some of the movies that came out last week. I do want to quickly mention the 12-hour horror fest that happened at the Movie Co. Theater, run by Flashback Convention, that I co-hosted with Steve Procopi, which was a blast. Started at noon, left at midnight. It was a blast. Got to introduce all the movies, and there were horror vendors there. We gave away prizes. It was a lot of fun. And there are a couple of movies that I had not seen on the big screen in many, many years. Original Night of the Living Dead, I hadn't seen that on the big screen in many years. Fright Night, I hadn't seen the original Fright Night on the big screen in a very long time. And that was fun. And then, of course,
Was Night of the Living Dead on DCP?
It was on DCP, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It looked great. Looked great. And so, yeah, it was a lot of fun. We had a good time. We had a nice turnout, gave away a lot of fun stuff. And, you know, of course, Phantasm Remastered and Phantasm Ravager opened in theaters last week. And those are two of the movies that now you guys didn't see either of them yet.
Not yet.
Okay. Now, you've seen Phantasm, but you just haven't seen the remastered version.
Right, right.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about some of the stuff that came out last week. There, I only saw one film last week. And it was The Birth of the Nation. So let's start with that. Colin, tell everybody real quick, just a quick synopsis of Birth of the Nation.
Okay. So this is the big Sundance movie we've been hearing about all year. Stars Nate Parker as Nat Turner, who led this uprising of slaves in the early 1800s. Armie Hammer plays his master. Aja Naomi King plays his wife. And he's a known preacher in the land. And, you know, the more he sees his people, you know, brutalized, the harder it is for him to remain silent. And so the movie leads up to this uprising. So this is a first-time film from Nate Parker. And, you know, it's a very ambitious first film. It's got, you know, all the earmarks of a movie that would be considered Oscar bait. It's got the big production values and the big, you know, you know, it's an historical epic. It's, you know, there to reclaim the title Birth of a Nation from the, you know, now racist D.W. Griffith silent era film. So it's got all the markings of a film that just, you know, wants to be, you know, great. And I think there are moments in the film that are great, but there is this sort of overwhelming feeling of a film by a director who is really out to give himself a lot of close-ups. Every scene is about him, no matter what. You know, his wife is brutalized, and, you know, they get a close-up of him and how he reacts to it. And the movie just has this kind of simplified idea of what it is to be, you know, a chosen one or a leader in something as, you know, extraordinary as this. You know, that's what this character is going through. He's going through a spiritual awakening to lead this uprising, which is pretty much a death wish. But there's nothing complex about that. It's just, he just kind of accepts it. And so there's really, when you leave the movie, they're not really there's really nothing to think about. You pretty much know where the story's going to go, and the movie kind of exists to satisfy the audience's bloodlust rather than telling a rich, complex story. I kept thinking of, you know, how well Scorsese did it with Last Temptation of Christ. You know, Christ was tormented, you know, for about being the chosen one. And this character is just kind of like, well, I guess I got to do it. I'll do it. And you know, so by the end of the film, it just kind of felt like a brutal experience, but a really kind of empty one too. So I'm not on board with Birth of a Nation.
Eric, you saw this at Sundance, correct?
Yeah. And if you can go back to one of our podcasts from Sundance back in January, I told you that I was not a fan of the film. And right in the middle of Sundance, when this, you know, the Oscar So White controversy was happening, this was basically greeted as the next coming of black cinema. And I saw it exactly the way Colin saw it. It's sort of a film that has all the trappings of an amateur filmmaker, someone who's taken on a subject matter that's well beyond his means. The religious aspects of the film feel very amateurish in the way it sort of is trying to incite the eventual violence. And by the time that comes, which is actually very late in the picture, you don't really get a really true sense of what this meant to the overall cause. And it feels like Colin said, it's sort of like a climactic bloodlust that is pretty much over before it even really has a chance to really begin. And we even mentioned the controversy about that, but we're reviewing the film, so we'll just review it as that. And the fact is that it's not a very good movie.
Yeah, it's not. I agree with you completely. I found it, all the buzz that we've been hearing now for, 9 months about this, although it has been tainted by the real-life controversy. But this was a film that I was very interested in seeing, and it's an amateur hour. I mean, it really truly is. And the director has got a massive ego from what it feels like when you're watching the film. And I wasn't connected to it at all. When the uprising and everything happens, I was so far removed from everything that happened beforehand, I just didn't care. So I'm voting a big no on this, and evidently everybody in the country is as well, Eric.
Oh yeah, very much so. This film was once was bought for $17.5 million at Sundance by Fox Searchlight because they thought they had a Best Picture winner.
Yeah.
On their hand, and this movie is dead now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, not good. Okay, so that was last week, Birth of a Nation, not doing very well, and we'll talk about the box office a little bit later on. Eric, tell us about American Honey.
Okay, American Honey is a new film by Andrea Arnold, who did Fish Tank and Red Road and Wuthering Heights remake. And it's the story of a young girl, I'm sorry, forgetting her, the actress's name at the moment, but who basically gets sort of kind of seduced in a way to going along on this road trip with sort of a group of other youngsters who are basically just sort of little scam artists. They're going around to soliciting money and trying to sell magazines to houses and whatnot. And it's all basically part of a big giant scam to suit their own endeavors. One of the led by Riley Keough and the other guy in the van that sort of takes a liking to this girl is played by Shia LaBeouf in what I think is actually the film's best performance. And it's basically this very long journey. This movie is over 2.5 hours. Sort of drive through America and really sort of trying to make sort of a commentary on sort of the vast classes that we have in this country. I'm a fan of Andrea Arnold's work in the past. I'm particularly a big fan of Fish Tank. And when I saw this movie at the Toronto Film Festival this year, it was at the end of a very long stretch of movies, and it was actually shown in the IMAX theater. So seeing this movie in the IMAX theater, I mean, you can really just, the buff just comes right off the screen at you. And it's quite a different experience, particularly when you're a little tired. And that was kind of my experience watching this movie, in that the longer it went on, the more tired I sort of grew a bit. Not always in a bad way. I felt that there was a bit of repetitiveness in it. I don't think the lead actress is particularly good.
Her name is Sasha Lane, by the way.
Sasha Lane. Okay, she's very much in the mold of Katie Jarvis, who was the lead in Fish Tank. There are a lot of parallels between the two characters, and I think Jarvis is far superior in that film. I think LaBeouf does give the best performance in the movie, even if he's kind of an insufferable character by the end as well. And I get what the movie is trying to do with trying to make a statement about this journey through America and the middle and the lower classes and certainly the upper class. And some of that I felt was a little too on the nose for my taste.
Yeah.
Here and there, like, I get it. They're raiding the oil barons, and I get it. And the way they're interject these things. So it's a movie that I'm looking forward to looking at again when I'm in maybe a better frame of mind. But at 2.5 hours, I don't know if it needed to be that long.
Okay, Colin, what do you think?
I agree, it's too long, and it feels too long. And I can totally see why Eric is not very enthusiastic about it. After if that's your last film of the day, you don't want that. You want this to be the first film you see of the day if you're going to really absorb it. I like the movie. I like it more than Eric does. But I did start to check my watch after about an hour and a half. That being said, I think scene for scene, this movie is worked really well. I think the director, I think she does a really terrific job of building the tension among all the characters and this one person who's just kind of the outsider at first. I also feel like that this is a movie that comes from a really authentic, place. I feel like this is a very well-researched film in terms of, the sort of the salesman tactics and it feels like this sort of thing still goes on in America, even though it doesn't feel like it should, like magazine door-to-door salesman, it's like doesn't feel like that's really a thing anymore. But I feel like, and maybe it is, and maybe it's just concocted for the film, but it feels real in this film. I liked where we were never really knowing where this was going in terms of the relationship between Sasha Lane and Shia LaBeouf. I thought the relationship dynamic there was very well done. And it's interesting that Shia LaBeouf can, sort of disappear among all these other seemingly like non-actors, this very well-cast movie of people who, it almost feels like you're watching a documentary, just kind of how, authentically, goofy and misplaced these people are. I don't feel like, I'm watching just a group of actors trying to convey that. I feel like I'm kind of there with them. It's not a perfect film. It could be trimmed quite a bit, but I thought, scene for scene, I thought it really worked.
Okay. All right. So that's American Honey and The Birth of a Nation. And we got a couple more quick ones to talk about from last week. Then we'll get into all the new movies. We were off last week, but the movie reviews will continue right after we take a break here for the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich in the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 a.m. Happy to be back. We missed our Monday morning movie reviews last week because I was off on vacation. So we're catching up on some of the movies that came out last week, and then we'll review all the new movies, and we'll talk box office as well. Later on in the show, we're going to try out some new pickup lines on Esmeralda. My dad will call in and tell a joke and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can check us out on Facebook at Nick D Show, Facebook/Nick D Show, and on Twitter at Nick D Show. We are catching up on some of the movies from last week with Eric Childress and Colin Suter, and let's welcome them back to the show. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right. Eric, why don't you guys, Eric, briefly give the plot and what you thought of The Girl on the Train, which was the big movie from last week, or it was number one.
Yeah, and it's based on a big bestseller, I guess, from 2015. And Emily Blunt plays an alcoholic woman who takes the train to work every day, and on her way notices the suburban lives of people in a neighborhood that she passes by, including a young nanny played by Haley Bennett, and another woman whose baby she watches, played by Rebecca Ferguson. Turns out that all of their lives are seemingly intertwined. And Emily Blunt's marriage to Justin Theroux had broken apart, and Rebecca Ferguson is partially responsible for that. And when the nanny goes missing, it's presumed that Emily Blunt either knows something about it or may actually be involved in her disappearance, considering that she spends a lot of the movie either drunk or passed out or blackout drunk. There's some weight to that. So the movie turns into basically this mystery of what exactly happened, who knew what and when, as the movie takes us through the three different points of views of the three different women at different points in the timeline, going back and forth and sideways more often than lost. And it's just, the movie is just a monumental mess. And I didn't read the book, but it's clearly it feels like someone read Gone Girl and said, hey, I could write that. And clearly they couldn't. It's not really absorbing as a mystery or a whodunit. Tate Taylor directed the film, and clearly it seems like he has no clue how to make any sort of Hitchcockian thriller, or whether he even set out to do that in the first place. So the movie more or less plays like some sort of psychological drama about, you know, unhappiness and depression. And even that, on that level, the movie is a huge failure. The fact that Emily Blunt, at least for me, doesn't quite cross over into the realm of self-parody is all on her and her talent. But Haley Bennett is completely vacant. Rebecca Ferguson is wasted. And, you know, there's only like six characters in this movie, so it's not too hard to figure out exactly who done what to whom. And it's just, it's really terrible. It's really one of the worst movies of the year.
Wow. Okay. McCollin?
Yeah, I don't really have too much more to add to that. It's just one of those movies where, yeah, the ending is not a big surprise. And what, you know, I think the movie starts out intriguingly enough. You're just walking into this cold, not knowing it's a murder mystery. It kind of starts out, you know, interestingly enough, as a character study on this, you know, suburban alcoholic woman who has blackouts. That's interesting material to start with, but the movie doesn't really know what to do with it, so it just kind of creates this kind of stupid, you know, murder mystery that isn't much of a mystery, and then by the end, it isn't really much of a character study either, because the characters are just kind of props that exist, you know, for the writer to play with and to, you know, throw MacGuffins our way every 15 minutes, but they're not real people, so it's just a stupid film.
Okay. All right. I'm glad I skipped it. All right.
Yeah.
Girl on the Train. All right. Well, listen, then. We'll do one more from last week. We'll talk about Colin, tell us about Middle School, because I was really interested in this movie. Well, one, Lauren Graham's in it, so that automatically that automatically makes me interested in it. But the trailer looked pretty funny. I thought the trailer looked pretty charming, and I was kind of looking forward to catching up on it.
Well, don't rush.
Okay.
This is based on a series of books, not unlike the Diary of Wimpy Kid movies. And it's a, you know, a 13-year-old kid has been to, you know, his third middle school because of his bad behavior. And this new school that he's at, you know, is against all forms of artistic expression. And on the first day of school, this kid has his notebook taken and burned before his very eyes. So he and his friend, you know, vow to break every rule in the school book. There's like 30 of them. But they try to do it in a way where they don't get caught. And wackiness ensues. I'm sure you've seen some of the results in the trailer. Yeah, and Lauren Graham, she's pretty much wasted here. She plays the kid's mom. Adam Pally plays, you know, the one cool teacher in the school. Andrew Daly plays the principal. I will give the movie this. It's not great. You know, maybe it's better than at least two of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid movies, in that at least it tries to be about something more than just kids' hijinks. And it's basically the kind of movie where all the kids are acting like adults and all the adults are acting like kids. you know, there's a certain value to that, I guess, if you're, you know, a 12-year-old and, you know, you just want to see a comedy like this, and, you know, but it's basically like a Disney Channel kind of film. The plot is actually, by the end, you realize it's very reminiscent of the plot to Pump Up the Volume, minus the radio show, of course, but it's like, you know, all the hijinks that you see around the school is basically the substitute for the radio show. But the plot is pretty much the same. All the conspiracy in the school that goes on in Pump Up the Volume, basically the same thing here. So I don't know. I've laughed a few times, and I give the movie points for, you know, having an emotional center that was kind of unexpected, and kind of an unexpected twist too. You know, this is just, it's aimed at a very particular audience that I think probably your average 10 or 11 year old who isn't very discerning with their, you know, films that they watch, mightn't, you know, probably enjoy it. But, you know, if you're a grown up, you don't really need to see it.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that, because I was kind of looking forward to it. And very, very briefly, because you reviewed it a couple of weeks ago, Eric, tell everyone what you thought of, and then we'll get Colin's reaction to Denial, because you just saw it in Toronto, correct?
Yeah, I saw it in Toronto, and this is also another film based on a true story of a court case a few years ago where a college professor who teaches Holocaust teachings at her college was challenged by a British anti-Holocaust denier, basically, who's written all kinds of books and gives speeches on how the Holocaust was basically a big myth and blown out of proportion, and leads her to being put on trial for libel. When she basically accuses him on the British court system, she becomes the one that has to supply the burden of proof against him. And it turns into this big court case that puts the Holocaust on trial. And Rachel Weisz plays the professor. Her lawyer is played by Tom Wilkinson, and Timothy Spall plays what's the guy's name? I'm forgetting.
David Irving.
David Irving. Yes, thank you. Plays David Irving in the court. And I actually like this movie quite a bit. I think the one problem with the movie is actually, of all things, the Rachel Weisz performance. She leans a little too heavily on her, I guess, Bostonian accent, I think it is. And she's constantly being told she's getting in the way of a trial by trying to sort of bring aspects of the Holocaust into the trial when the trial needs to be about something more than that. And I thought it was kind of refreshing to have her legal team become a big focus of the movie. And I think Wilkinson is really good. I think Timothy Spall is really good. I like what this movie had to say, and I think it kind of avoids sort of the usual trappings of the kind of the preachiness that we tend to see and the earnestness that we tend to see in movies like this, and really sort of focus more on the legal aspects of the case. I thought that was a very interesting movie.
Okay. David Harrico wrote it, which he's one of the best writers, you know, one of the most amazing playwrights ever. Mick Jackson directed this. What's he been doing lately?
Yeah, I asked the same question.
It's been a long time since he's made a movie. So if I can, I'll look it up. But I think it's been a while. Colin, what did you think?
He did the Temple Grandin TV movie a few years ago.
Ah, okay.
That was wow. So, yeah, I'm not quite as big a fan of it as Eric is. I think it does get a little too preachy, a little too obvious in its points. I think a lot of the complexities of it kind of take a backseat to the heightened emotions and you know, Howard Shore's, you know, music swelling as the character gets closer and closer to their point. And I just think the movie misses an opportunity to sort of expound on why, you know, a backwards mindset can be so frightening when you realize that this person doesn't see themselves as a monster or, you know, a criminal or, you know, a Holocaust denier. You know, I kind of wanted a little more. I kind of wanted to know a little bit more about David Irving's background. And you know, why was this fight so important to him? But I think the movie, you know, missed out on that, unfortunately. I do think it's what is interesting, though, is the film, the release of it and the timing of it. I think there are a lot of – it's an interesting parallel to the election that's going on right now.
Yeah.
The two main characters who are fighting against each other, there's something very interesting about that. I like that aspect of it. I think it's just okay. I don't love it. I don't hate it. I think it's okay.
Okay. All right. Well, those are the movies that we were talking about from last week. And so that's American Honey, The Birth of a Nation, Denial, The Girl on the Train, and Middle School. Boy, it wasn't a real good week last week.
Not really.
Okay. So it's good thing I took it off. all right. Well, there were a couple of Phantasm movies that were released in the theaters last week. Those are good. And Ravager, I just want to say Ravager is an absolutely wonderful way to end the series. It's sort of the perfect bookend to the original movie, whereas the first movie is like this fever dream about the fears of death from a 14-year-old kid's perspective, and this one is the fears of death and fear from a guy who might be dealing with dementia who's much older. So to have those perspectives bookended, and to have seen the movie when I was 13, and to have seen this last movie when I'm 51 and I'm middle-aged, it's kind of weird how the effect that these two films as bookends have. It's a great emotional ending to the series, and it's goofy and slapdash and as crazy as any Coscarelli movie, even though he didn't direct it, but he clearly had a hand in every frame of it. But I highly recommend if you're a Phantasm fan. I think it's still in a couple of theaters, but it's definitely available on VOD, and so is Phantasm Remastered. And so if you're a fan of the series, you really got to see Phantasm Ravager. It's kind of just a real gift to the hardcore Phantasm fans. So all right, we'll take a break, you guys, and we'll come back and we'll review new movies. All right.
Okay.
All right. Cool. So we've got Colin and we've got Eric and we've got more new movies to talk about. Well, we got new movies to talk about. Coming up after we take a break is Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6. I'm happy to be back on a Monday morning. My dad will call in and tell a joke a little bit later on. Right now, though, we are in the middle of telling you about the new movies on the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every week. From eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more, we review the new movies, and then Eric sticks around, and we discuss box office. So we've got all the new movies to talk about, and we welcome Colin. Welcome back, Colin.
Hello.
And Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, Eric.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the IMDb page for a movie called Confessions of a Womanizer.
Oh, yeah.
This is a real thing?
This is a real movie.
Okay. I won't give anything away. You give everybody the little lovely treat.
Yeah.
I read the synopsis, the very short synopsis, uh-huh. And then the cast.
Yeah.
Okay.
You might have to help me with the cast names, other than one particular cast name, which I'm going to bring up prefacing this review.
All right. Well, there's two cast names that really stick out.
Okay.
Two.
Okay. I definitely know one of them.
Okay.
Well, I need to preface this review by saying that we get screener requests and people want you to look at their movies all the time. And, tons of movies. There are actually more movies that open around the Chicagoland area. This one's is at the Streets of Woodfield, correct? I believe?
Yes.
Okay. It's the only theater where this list is playing, and we got a request to check the movie out. And in the... Well, first I'll tell you what the movie is about. The movie's called Confessions of a Womanizer, and it's about a guy who tells a story of in sort of like a train wreck-like childhood. He basically discovered that being nice to women is not going to get him anywhere. So he's going to live his life as a womanizer and just use women for sex and pleasure and no commitment or emotions or anything else. So this is our hero, okay? And as the movie progresses, it seems like it's going to be one of these tales where he finds the love of his life and he's going to learn to be a better man and emotions and commitments and all that kind of stuff. And he seems like he finds that woman very early on, and then but 15 minutes later, he cheats on her, and then there's another woman, and then there's another woman. And all the meanwhile, in between all these women, he's always eating at this diner where the Bella twins from WWE are always hitting on him.
Right.
They play waitresses. And he's hanging with his two best buddies, one guy, and then another older gentleman played by the one and only Gary Busey.
Right. So okay. The cast that I was talking about were not actually there are four total because the Bella twins. I saw the Bella twins were in this.
Yeah.
And then Gary Busey, but the other cast member, C. Thomas Howell.
Oh yeah, C. Thomas Howell plays his father.
Oh God.
C. Thomas Howell plays the womanizing father, the guy that basically put in his head that this is the type of life he should be leading.
Oh,
he was
awesome.
not good to his mom. And all the kind of stuff. And he just, you know, loud C. Thomas Howell with a mustache.
Okay.
Okay. Right. So in the request for the review, we were asked to give serious consideration to Gary Busey for Best Supporting Actor.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And it also, and then if that wasn't enough, that if we could in our reviews to mention whether or not we think that Gary Busey should be considered for Best Supporting Actor. So I'll say two things about this. One, no. But two, he's the only interesting thing about the entire movie.
Okay.
This is a movie that seems like it was completely written by the Urban Dictionary.
Oh, okay.
Okay, there's absolutely nothing good about it, except Gary Busey, who shows up and basically is sort of the locker room Trump talk guy of the movie, interjected with Buseyisms that make you kind of chuckle at their absurdity. He's in the movie for maybe all of 15 minutes.
Okay,
it's absolutely awful, and the only reason I brought it up because of this bizarre request to consider him for Best Supporting Actor.
Sure.
So when you see him on your film critics ballot this year, you could check Gary Busey if you'd like.
just consider.
Yeah, consider Gary Busey. Because he will be on the ballot. I'm going to put him on the ballot for everyone.
That's so funny. That's so funny. All right, that's Confessions of a Womanizer. with C. Thomas Howell, Gary Busey, and the Bella twins.
Yeah.
All right. We got to take a break. I think we need to take a break after that. Guys, hang on a second. We got the news here, and then we'll come back after the news and finish up all the new movie reviews, and we'll talk box office as well. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's a Monday morning. My dad will be calling in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we got more coming up here. We're going to test out some new pickup lines on Esmeralda, and that's going to be coming up. Plus more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. And there you go. So let's talk a little bit about the new. We got Eric and Colin here, and we're talking about the new movies. Hi guys, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hello,
Colin. You saw the Justin Timberlake doc.
Yes, I did.
Tell us all about it. It's called Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids.
Yeah, so this is a concert film from Jonathan Demme, and that should be enough to get you excited, regardless of whoever the artist is. Demme is the king of the concert films. Made Stop Making Sense, Thorfinn Hitchcock, Swimming to Cambodia, and a dozen Neil Young movies as well.
Yeah.
So Justin Timberlake having Jonathan Demme film his concert is just a smart move. And, I think the two are, a damn good match. This is Justin Timberlake has like a 20-piece band with him on this, big stadium tour, arena tour promoting the 2020 album that came out a couple of years ago. And it's a really terrific film. I mean, you kind of get to know the musicians a little bit at the beginning. And I don't own any Timberlake albums. I know, a couple of the big hits pretty much. But that didn't stop me from enjoying the film. I think it's beautifully shot. I think one of the things that Demme does really well in all of his films is capturing that sense of joy from the artist, having that elation and, feeling like, they were born to do what they do. And in that great Demme fashion, letting the camera linger on the performance for a long period of time instead of, overcutting, which a lot of concert filmmakers make the mistake of doing. The movie at the end is dedicated to Prince, and I think that's very fitting. I think this movie is in line with Stop Making Sense and Sign of the Times as being just this 90-minute burst of energy that is just nonstop. And when I was watching it, I was kind of like, well, this is a cool stage that Timberlake has here, but he really needs a B stage. He really needs like a ramp to go into the audience. And, you know, it's a great way of an artist to connect with the audience. Well, the big act do that. Well, about halfway through the film, you'll see what this stage can really do. And it's pretty great. It's pretty extraordinary, better than a B stage. It's pretty amazing. So I recommend if you can watch this on a big screen, you should. And it's kind of too bad that it just went direct to Netflix, because it's a movie that demands to be seen on as big a screen as possible. And I really wish I had that, you know, opportunity. But nevertheless, this is a really terrific, really fun concert film. And, you know, if you've never seen Timberlake, you know, do what he does, you know, really well, this is a great place to start. Basically my exposure to a, you know, Justin Timberlake concert. And this guy really knows what he's doing with that space and giving the audience the bang for their buck.
Yeah, he rules. I know it's on Netflix. I have not watched it, but I happen to be a really big Justin Timberlake fan.
And you'll be happy.
When I heard that Jonathan Demme was directing it, I went, "What?" It, you know, right there. So I've not seen it, but obviously it's on the Netflix. And so Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, highly recommended by Colin. All right. Eric, tell us again about Deserto.
Oh, yes. Deserto was a film that I saw at the Toronto Film Festival the prior year, in 2015. Stars Gael Garcia Bernal as a Mexican coming over to find work. He's coming in with a bunch of illegals across the border, documenting exactly how they do that. Problem is that when they reach the border, reach to where they're going to be crossing over on foot, there is a militiaman, a Minuteman, played by Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who's going to set up shop and just pick people off with his rifle before they can get into the great U.S. of A. So this leads to a pretty extraordinarily tense sequence as everyone just starts running for their lives while this idiot starts just killing them one by one. And it gets us down to in sort of a classic kind of 70s fashion, where you have a small group of survivors that remain as they try to outwit this guy, forget just getting across the border, just getting across anywhere with their lives intact. And it becomes a sort of this cat and mouse game between all of them. I like this film for the most part. I think the film, the early scenes, particularly the first hour, have radiated a really solid amount of tension. I think when it gets down to just a few people, the cat, you know, there's only so many places you can go in a open landscape and a lot of rocks. There's only so many places you can hide. And sort of once it gets down to sort of a mano-a-mano kind of situation, the tension dissipates a little bit, just because it doesn't get to go too many places. The film is directed by Jonas Caron, Alfonso Caron's son, and I think he does a pretty good job with a very wide landscape and doing the best he can to create tension out of that situation. The score, I think, is actually really good from what I remember about it. It's not a great film. I think it's certainly a flawed film, but I think, you know, anyone who sort of likes those tense sort of 70s survival type movies will find something interesting in this. I'm sure Donald Trump certainly will.
I have I wanted to see this, but it's only playing in two theaters, and one I can't get to because I don't drive. And the other, the showtimes never worked out. So I really wanted to see this movie over the weekend. I didn't get a chance because I'm a fan of, you know, his dad, and I think Jonas Caron, you know, is a good screenwriter, if anything. But I know that this is his first film he's ever directed, and it's an interesting premise. So I do actually, I'm interested in seeing it, and I remember your review of it. Where did you see it? You saw it at
Toronto in 2015.
Year in 2015.
Yeah,
in Toronto. Okay. All right, so that's Deserto, and that's playing right now, and it's only playing at two theaters. It's the City North, the Regal City North, and at the AMC Showplace in Cicero. So those are the only two places it's playing. All right. All right, Colin, we have another Netflix movie to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell everybody about Mascots?
All right. Well, this is the latest comedy from Christopher Guest, and I hesitate to call his films mockumentaries because it never really goes beyond the talking head format to show, you know, that these are real people. This is very similar to his previous films, Waiting for Guffman, Mighty Wind, and Best in Show, in that it is all building up to a performance. In this case, it's Mascots, people in oversized costumes at sporting events. Of course, the people in Christopher Guest's film take the role of mascot very seriously, to the point of absurdity. And this is a competition, of course, so now, you know, their behavior is even more laughable, or it's meant to be. Guest, you know, he has his usual cast here. He's got, you know, Parker Posey, Jane Lynch, Fred Willard, who, of course, you know, has the most laughs in the film, but basically doing the Fred Willard thing. Christopher Guest himself, you know, plays his character Corky from Waiting for Guffman, you know, and then he's got the usual, you know, he's got Bob Balaban, Ed Begley Jr., but now he's got new cast members, Zach Woods, Sarah Baker, Chris O'Dowd, and the camera jumps from one storyline to another, but it's all pretty much the same joke or, you know, story about competitive mascotting and the goofballs who engage in it. And I think it's pretty safe to say that the well is officially dry for Christopher Guest. This is really just him rehashing old ideas, stale ideas, and not doing anything with it that is remotely fresh or original. Again, these are not mockumentaries anymore. He just basically has the characters talk to the camera at the beginning of the film, and then the rest is basically straightforward narrative. Even, you know, in terms of form, it's not very interesting anymore. I laughed maybe a couple times, you know, usually Fred Willard, but that was about it. And I just think this is a movie that is just completely bankrupt in terms of ideas and freshness. And I think it's time for, you know, this Christopher Guest to just kind of stop with this and maybe just try to make a real narrative film about real people instead of just, you know, getting a bunch of actors together to play characters that we're supposed to laugh at for 90 minutes and not laugh with or sympathize with. So this is a, you know, real misfire for Christopher Guest.
I agree with you 100%. And I am not a fan of Christopher Guest's other movies, as I've mentioned before. I find his films to be really mean-spirited. He hates the characters that he creates. The jokes are always at the expense of the characters. And like you said, Colin, you don't laugh with them, you laugh at them. There's a real every single one of the Christopher Guest movies leaves a real bad taste in my mouth after I'm done watching them. And I don't necessarily think they're particularly hilarious either. I don't think people are, you know, I don't think putting a camera on people who can improvise pretty well and letting them do whatever the hell they want within a structure that's very judgmental is a very clever thing to do. And this is, oh yeah, I mean, this the well is, I thought the well was dry a few films back, but the well is way dry here. And the other thing that's ridiculous about this is that I laugh my ass off at Mascots. I think Mascots are the funniest thing in the world. And if you've listened to this show, you know that. Like, anytime they cut to a sideline, there's a mascot there. It brings me joy. I didn't laugh at anything in this movie. Yeah, so, and again, extraordinarily talented people, very, very funny people. And like you, Colin, the two or three times I may have chuckled was because of Fred Willard. But outside of that, it's the same stuff over and over and over again. And it's, in my opinion, it's never been very funny, and it's always been pretty mean. So I, big no to Mascots at this point on Netflix. So, all right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got to take a break. We got one more movie to talk about, and then we will talk more about the box office. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Hi. Monday morning. My dad will be calling to tell a jokey time. And we're wrapping up with the movie reviews. We got one more new movie that came out this weekend to review. Eric Childress, Colin Suter are with me, and then we're going to talk about box office. And Colin and Eric, welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hey, nobody went to go see the crazy Kevin Hart movie?
No, they screened it against something else that was more interesting, I guess.
Yeah. I couldn't make heads nor tails out of the trailer. So, like, it's like a fake movie with him and Halle Berry doing a heist, and then he goes to the concert?
Something like that. Yeah.
Boy, you want to talk about padding a movie?
Mm-hmm.
Jeez. All right.
I saw the last Kevin Hart concert film and wasn't that impressed, so I didn't feel the need to go see another one. So.
All right. Well, he does, you know, people find him very funny and he's very popular, and I like that last movie he was in with The Rock. I know you hated it, Eric.
Yep.
But I thought it was funny. So we'll talk about how it did at the box office in a few minutes. But the other big movie that opened this week, it was number one at the box office, and we'll talk about that. Eric, tell us about The Accountant.
Okay. Well, The Accountant stars Ben Affleck as not a accountant, but the accountant. And he's being, in his world, he is being investigated by the Treasury Department, led by J.K. Simmons. Apparently, he is doing business with some of the worst people in the world, cooking their books, laundering money, and things like that. And he gets hired to deal with a tech company run by John Lithgow. Apparently, there's missing money on their books, and because of his skill set, that they believe that he'll be able to find the missing money, or at least confirm that someone might be embezzling some money. One thing that we know about the accountant very early on is that he has sort of a form of autism. He has some Asperger's condition and has gone through some counseling in his youth, and apparently he has now taken that to do what he's doing now, which is, you know, using his skills for either his own just getting his own life together, but also obviously cooking the books of all these other people. But when he does discover that things are going bad at this tech company, he ends up going on the run protecting one of the people that discovered the initial discrepancy, played by Anna Kendrick. And it turns out he's also quite the guy with the fists and the guns, and you know, you do not want to mess with his accountant. And also stalking them is another assassin played by John Berthal, who is also been dealing with the tech company and some other Wall Street types to protect their investments, and it becomes a big chase movie in a way. Describing this movie in any sort of linear fashion will not do it justice to what it actually is about. As this movie began, I found it kind of intriguing, just different. It was sort of interesting. Couldn't wait to see where it was going to go. Then when it sort of takes its first turn in the film, it gets kind of ridiculously goofy, but in kind of a fun way. And I couldn't wait to see where it was going to go next. And then it just kind of settles into just kind of a standard chase revenge, you know, movie that kind of strips away a lot of the interesting stuff that we thought we were going to find out about this character. And the best way for me to sort of describe the experience of watching this movie is something I couldn't stop thinking about while I was watching it, is back in like late 1999, early 2000, Ben Affleck hosted an episode of Saturday Night Live. And he did a sketch where Matt Damon was out with talented Mr. Ripley at the time. And Ben Affleck did the sketch where he essentially became Matt Damon in a Mr. Ripley kind of way. And that's exactly what this movie is, because he starts the movie off as Will Hunting and he becomes Jason Bourne. And when he becomes Jason Bourne, the more he settles into that, and that's pretty much all he becomes in the back half of this movie, it's just not that interesting. There are twists upon twists that are twists only to the filmmakers themselves. They're not twists to anyone who's actually paying attention to the movie. When you have J.K. Simmons start the movie off with a line that says, "Do you like puzzles?" And I'm like, "Why, yes, I do, Mr. Simmons." It's then I don't want the movie to then put the puzzle together for me. I'd like to actually have a little bit of, just a little bit of time to put the thing together myself. And there's actually a scene very late in the film where the film just stops dead faster than the end of Psycho for J.K. Simmons to explain a lot of the backstory of this movie. And it doesn't explain so much. It just keeps adding layers to this thing that it didn't really need. So by the time of the end, by the end of this movie, I was just not so much exhausted, but just kind of like the air had been sort of let out of my balloon by, you know, what I was hoping this movie was going to be about something more. And like I said, there's a plot twist in the movie that the reveal for it is just so elongated to the fact it's just like, it's like a Mystery Science Theater episode where you just, everyone's going like, okay, and then that happens. We know what's going to happen. Just tell us that's who that person is. We know it. And I was just, the reveal of that is just so ridiculous. So I'm certainly a mixed bag, but I got to go down on the accountant.
Yeah, you just made a segment on Friday Morning Show, my friend.
Did I?
Yes, you did.
Oh,
straight,
yeah.
Out of context, my friend. Hold on, okay. A second. There's Colin and there's Eric, and we'll come back, and Colin and myself will give you our opinions on The Accountant, and then we'll quickly go through the box office as well. All right, coming up right after this on WGN. Cool. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. A little bit later on, we're going to be trying out some new pickup lines on Esmeralda Leon. My dad will call in to tell a joke because it's a jokey time. It's Monday. And more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. Check us out on Facebook. Best way to stay connected. It's interactive, constantly updated. Facebook.com/NickDShow. Like us now. And follow us on Twitter at NickDShow. We're in the middle of reviewing The Accountant. Eric gave it a mixed bag at best. And this was Bill Affleck. Yeah, his brother, Bill. Ben Affleck's new movie. And let's find out what Colin thinks of The Accountant. Go ahead, Colin.
This feels like one of my guilty pleasures of the year. This movie is absolutely absurd, preposterous, ridiculous at every plot turn. And Eric's right. Describing it is really hard. And it is about as goofy as it sounds. I can't defend the movie detractors that grade it poorly for having such a contrived and ridiculous storyline. I can't defend that, but I also can't deny that I kind of enjoyed it in spite of that. I agree, Eric says the reveal at the end is just like, okay, we know who this character is. Just get to it. But I think once they do reveal it, I think it's actually pretty funny, like the way it's played out. I think like some of the reaction shots are actually pretty hilarious. So I don't know. I can't help it. Just kind of give this movie a favorable review, even though I know it's not that great. It's not very good. It's also interesting that the movie is directed by Gavin O'Connor, who made Warrior, and this is kind of another film about a father and sons kind of reconciling, or I guess, on a much sillier level on this film.
And fighting,
yes. There's some mixed martial arts in this movie at one point. So I think, you know, that's probably what drew him to this project. I guess this might be his companion piece to Warrior. Certainly nowhere near as good as Warrior, obviously, because that movie is great. And this is just kind of a silly, messy, contrived, stupid, but ultimately enjoyable film, in my opinion. I kind of give it a recommendation, but there's great films out or are coming out that you should go see before you go see this one. But, you know, for a silly thriller, you can certainly do a lot worse. Girl on the Train is certainly a lot worse than that. So.
Okay. I'm with Colin on this one. I had a good time. I did. And yeah, it just gets ridiculous as it goes along, more ridiculous and more ridiculous as it goes along. The guy who wrote this movie, I look back, he enjoys writing movies about daddy issues.
Oh, yeah.
Because he wrote The Judge. He enjoys writing movies about daddy issues. And this movie is totally about daddy issues. I want to mention Ben Affleck's performance because I think Ben Affleck's really good in this. Throughout the ridiculous arc that his character has, there wasn't a moment in this movie, whether it was at the beginning when he was like weirdly sympathetic and very, very interesting, to at the end when he kills like 526 guys. I found him to hold the screen really wonderfully, and I bought him in both of those different kind of characters that he was playing under the one guise of this character. I think it's extremely well made. The final big battle shootout thing is beautifully shot and very exciting. The fight scenes are good. There is a scene that takes place on a farm where these assassins show up at this guy's farm that is really beautifully done and ends hilariously. Like the final moment of that scene is hysterical. And, you know, J.K. Simmons is it does like at the point where J.K. Simmons is literally got his feet up on a table.
Yeah.
Laying on the couch, explaining everything. I was like, come on. Isn't there a better way to have woven those things into the movie than to literally stop it for 15 minutes so that J.K. Simmons can lay on a couch and tell everybody what's happening?
It goes on for that long, too.
It is seriously like 15 minutes of him just talking and then flashbacks and stuff. So I thought that was bad. Nobody mentioned Anna Kendrick. I thought Anna Kendrick was really great. I think she's got a really wonderful moment in this movie. This sort of goofy monologue about a black dress that she wanted to buy that was supposed to be kind of this lead up to a romantic scene possibly between her and Ben Affleck. Her reaction to going into his trailer is great. Some of the stuff that he has in his trailer, just the little quick shots of some of the things that he has in his trailer, and I won't give anything away. I love that stuff. So in terms of, like, the action, I liked it. The shootouts, the fights, it does get preposterous. And that twist that they have that you guys both mentioned is so obvious that by the time they do reveal it, it is like, okay, well, everybody in the theater knew that. But I will say this. There's another sort of twist surprise at the very end in postscript about another character who you find out who that character is that surprised me.
Oh, but it's even dumber.
Well, I don't care if it's dumb. It surprised me. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. They brought that character back, and then there's a payoff there. And then there's a nice payoff at the end with Anna Kendrick because she's gone from the movie for like 40 minutes. You know what I mean? She's in the first half of the movie, and then she's gone. And they bring her back at the end, and I think there's a real nice sort of sweet, kind of funny and ridiculous, you know, way that they tie up that relationship. Yeah, it's not great. It's ridiculous. But I got to tell you, I had a good time from beginning to end, and I like the performances, and I think it's very, very well made, but it's silly as hell. But I still liked it. So that's The Accountant. And it was number one at the box office this week with $24.7 million. All right. Eric, what do we got next week?
There's a bunch of stuff coming on next week. There's a new Jack Reacher film.
Tyler Perry. Tyler Perry's got a new
Tyler
movie.
Tyler Perry's Halloween movie, Keeping Up with the Joneses.
Right.
Comes out next week.
Ouija board movie.
The Ouija Origin of Evil, Ouija 2.
Right.
Coming out. Lots of stuff.
Lots of stuff next week. So, and In the Valley of Violence, by the way, comes out, which I know a lot of
people
are
looking forward to. Yes, the new Ty West film.
Yeah, new Ty West Western. Ty Western.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll review all those. Eric, stick around. Colin, we'll say good morning to you. Thanks, buddy, and welcome back.
Alrighty.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
There you go. All right, Eric, let's talk about this box office here.
Yeah.
Real quick, The Accountant, $24.7 million. Now, it's interesting that you wrote about this. People can read about this on movies.com because you analyze the box office every week. You wrote about how they altered expectations. Talk a little bit about how, because of the films that have been hyped are underperforming, suddenly they're altering things.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about it in kind of a little bit of a conspiratorial tone a bit, because you hear these tracking companies that basically give studios sort of an advanced lead on how, based on social media and marketing and people's awareness, it's mostly based on people's awareness. If they know it from commercials and things, that they say, like, well, if they're aware of it, they're going to go see it. A certain percentage are going to go see it. So they've been, you know, they do this every week, and this past summer was sort of a disaster for tracking companies. There was so many movies that they overestimated, a lot of movies that underperformed. And even now in the fall season, we've had a lot of these over the past couple of weeks. Magnificent Seven was slated to be somewhere in the low 40s, 40 million, and only opened to like 34 million. You had A Girl on the Train last week was supposed to open to somewhere over 30 million, and it only opened to just under 25. And then all of a sudden this week, The Accountant, they were going like, well, we're thinking like 15 to 20, maybe 18 to 20 if people get out and see it.
Uh-huh.
And look what happened, $24.7 million. All of a sudden, well, it exceeded expectations.
Got it. Yeah, it's interesting. Now, in terms of like Ben Affleck lead roles, Where does this one rank? Obviously, under because the Batman and the Superman is the number one, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a pretty solid opening for him. I mean, even his, his directorial efforts have not, they've gone on to, gross a lot of money, but they weren't like huge openers.
And by the way, his new movie looks great.
Doesn't it though?
Oh man!
Yeah, it looks really good.
Oh,
the man can direct.
Yes,
we've said this many times.
Yes, he can.
But as an actor, like Batman vs. Superman, Pearl Harbor, Daredevil, Gone Girl, obviously. So I think it was sixth, I think, it ranked amongst his top movies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty, I think it opened higher than The Town did and even Argo. So it's a solid opening for Affleck. Whether or not, how far the film goes from here, that's kind of a curiosity. Not a huge budgeted film.
Yeah.
So it has a chance to actually make it into profit.
Okay. Kevin Hart, What Now? Came in second with just about $12 million total. And that's an improvement from his last concert film, correct?
Yeah, and his last concert film only opened on like 850 screens when it started. So and this one actually went wide. Universal took this one out in the 2,500 screens.
Wow.
So I mean, this per screen average is down, but the $11.9 million, I believe it opened to, is the highest opening ever for a concert film.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And his last concert, the last one, Let Me Explain, is the fourth highest grossing concert film of all time, behind Raw, Eddie Murphy's, Richard Pryor and the Sunset Strip, and the original Kings of Comedy.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't quite get it, but it's amazing. Girl on the Train, $11.9 million, total $46.5 million. This is underperforming as well, correct?
Yeah. I mean, again, based on the tracking expectations, there was probably some hope that this was going to be, do at least kind of semi-Gone Girl numbers, and it clearly didn't open to as high as Gone Girl, and took a 51% drop this week. It's still going to end up with somewhere around $65 million plus, and so if it fails, it's not a big failure, and if it makes it a profit, it'll be a small profit. So it's skirting the line right now. We'll see where it goes, especially with the international market over the coming weeks.
It's interesting how many times we can use the word underperforming here. But, well, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, $8.9 million, bringing its total up to about $65.8 million. That's not terrible.
It's not terrible. I mean, it's still skirting the sort of Maze Runner sequel numbers. It might surpass Scorch Trials when all is said and done. And it's done $130 million overseas. Obviously, it's got some international appeal to it with the cast and the setting and things like that.
Yeah.
And of all the only real fall movie that it can really be generated as a success is Sully.
Yeah.
Sully, and that's not going to be a huge profit for Warner Brothers and them, but it's going to be a profit, and that's a lot more than we could say about a lot of these movies. Of all of the other ones on the list, Miss Peregrine probably has maybe the best chance of the big movies of turning a profit thanks to the international dollars, but
right.
It still has quite a ways to go.
And then finally, we got to close very, very quickly with The Birth of a Nation. We talked about it earlier. In 2 weeks, it's made $12.2 million. This has got to be a disaster.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, Sergio Mims, actually, our friend, did a whole piece about because there are a lot of people now that are jabbing conspiratorial jabs at this one, too, why the movie is underperforming and things like that. It was too important to succeed and all these kind of things. And he actually estimated that this movie needs to make somewhere around $65 million with all the marketing and stuff for Fox Searchlight to be seen a profit. And, movies with, African-American themed films do not do business overseas. They just don't.
Yeah.
So you're not going to see any kind of makeup dollar over there.
Right.
And this film doesn't look like it's even going to match the $17.5 million that they paid for it at Sundance.
Yeah, interesting. It's one of the most interesting stories of the year.
It absolutely is.
No question. Okay, Eric, always great to talk to you, man, and we will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, Eric Childress and Colin Suter, and that's the movie reviews.